Margaret May's mother was a community activist, so it's no surprise that the beloved neighborhood spokeswoman knows a thing or two about how to mobilize a community. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll get to know Margaret May. We'll also learn more about the Ivanhoe neighborhood she represents. Some residents are frustrated by vacant houses on their blocks, while others are loving the new farmers market and pointing, with a sigh of relief, to reduced crime rates. Plus, hear from one Ivanhoe woman who's been dutifully picking up trash in her neighborhood for decades. That story and more on Central Standard, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to talk about the Ivanhoe neighborhood with some of the people who know it best. A few weeks ago, KCUR held a listening session in Ivanhoe, and the turnout was great. We heard from a lot of Ivanhoe residents who cared deeply about their neighborhood. Difficult issues like crime and vacant houses were on the forefront of people's minds, and we'll get to those issues. But there was also a strong sense that a lot is going right in the neighborhood. And the people we met all seem to agree that one of the things that's going right is Margaret May. She's the leader of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council, and she's with me in the studio today. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Well, first of all, tell our listeners where Ivanhoe is and maybe a little bit about what it's like in case they're unfamiliar.
Well, the Ivanhoe neighborhood is located on the north, 31st Street, south, Emmanuel Cleaver. To the east is Prospect, and to the west is Paseo. And we have a lot of good things going on in Ivanhoe and the greatest people in town.
The greatest people in town, a bold assertion.
That's right. They live right in the Ivanhoe neighborhood.
Well, when and how did you first get involved with the neighborhood?
Well, I work in Ivanhoe. Back in the late 90s, when the neighborhood started to chart a course for revitalization, the Kauffman Foundation became aware of what they were doing, and in 2000, help them to develop a strategic plan by having the KU Work Group to work with them.
Well, when you say they had started to chart a course for improving their neighborhood, can you describe a little bit more about what you mean?
Well, in the 1990s, Ivanhoe, like many center city neighborhoods, was really a bad place. People were afraid to come out of their houses and sit on their front porches at that time. Crime was running rampant, drug houses every place, and toward the end of the 90s and 97, the Young family decided to fight six drug houses on their block. They were successful in having a prayer vigil, and I'm going to just say almost overnight succeeded in getting those houses closed. And after that point, they met with just a very small number of people. Mrs. Dockery, that's going to be on with us in just a minute, was one of them, and Mrs. Laura Townsend, and they started charting the course. You know, it takes sometimes just two or three people doing something, and if they're really serious about it, then they attract others. And that's what happened in Ivanhoe.
And that partly led to a position for which you were hired. Can you tell us about that?
That's correct. The strategic plan that the neighborhood developed called for opening an office and also hiring staff. And they had a competitive process, and I was hired in October of 2001.
And part of what you did was create a center that the community really coalesces around these days.
That's true. And to start, we were at the Harold Thomas Center in an office space there. But the dream of the neighborhood was to have their own building. And they had already selected the building and talked with the city about acquiring the building.
What was it about that building that they liked? What was going on there?
Well, it was a vacant building at the time and had been for 15 years. But prior to that, it was built in 1904 as a fire station and continued as a fire station until about 72. And then at some point after that, the city made it the boxing center. And a lot of folks in the city actually participated there and in the Golden Gloves and have fond memories of the time there. So We had a person to visit the building once, and he said, you know, Ivanhoe is very much like the purposes of this building. You guys put out fires sometimes, and sometimes you have to box. You have to fight to make things happen. And so that's sort of a good analogy for what goes on and how we get things accomplished in the neighborhood.
What were some of the most pressing issues at the time that you arrived to start helping this community that had already begun, you know, fighting its own battles and having some real triumphs? But what were some of the things people were bringing to your attention?
Well, the biggest problem at that time was drug houses. I'm told that there was a drug house on virtually every block in the neighborhood. Ivanhoe's a very big neighborhood. And if you can imagine, it's hard to imagine, but drug houses on almost every block is just something that's really, really bad. It takes a lot of courage when people in a neighborhood decide that they're going to get rid of those. And so they'd already started that process. We had the highest crime rate in the whole city. Trash and litter every place, illegal dumping every place. It was just not a good thing. And again, people cared who lived there, but things were so bad they were afraid to come out of their homes. So that small, courageous group that began this process is really to be applauded, because if it hadn't been for their strong vision and will and courage, we would certainly not be where we are today.
Can you tell me just a little bit more about the kinds of things people had already been doing? I totally sympathize with what you're saying. That would be scary to just, as a regular person, try to confront a problem as big and as dangerous as prevalent drug houses.
Again, back to the Youngs fighting the drug houses on their block. They had six of them, and they organized a prayer vigil where they literally went to every single house on the block, sang and prayed, moved on to the next and the next. And that's what caused the five of those drug houses to close almost immediately. And then the sixth owner that did not close, he was murdered a short time later in another neighborhood, I'm told.
Wow.
So most of the closings of drug houses in the neighborhood weren't quite that dramatic, but the fact that that was such a big thing, and it inspired the Youngs then to connect with other people in the neighborhood. And it's inspiring today just to think that, you know, you could actually do something and get drug houses closed in that manner. So it encourages people in the neighborhood to call when there are drug house. If they see illegal drug sales, they call, let us know, and then we get to working with the police.
Well, we will get back to Margaret May shortly to hear more about her work and her story. But first, I'd like to turn to one of those residents who had already been doing everything she could to make her neighborhood as good as it could be when Margaret May arrived. It's time to invite Ida Dockery to join the conversation by phone. Ida, you're taking a break from some exercise to speak with us. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Well, we really appreciate it. We know that's important to you. How long have you lived in Ivanhoe?
Since 1960.
And what drew you to Ivanhoe in particular?
Well, at that time, my husband and I, and we had a family, two boy and girl, was looking for places to live. And, you know, of course, with little children, and they were 2 or 3 years old at that time. We were looking for a school, a house near the bus line, and several things. So we found this place here. That was at that time near the Horseman School, the bus line, all that.
Tell us a little bit more about Ivanhoe in 1960 when you arrived. Paint the picture for us.
Ivanhoe in 1960 was very nice. It was quiet, and that was at the time when the people began to move from the inner city to the, I guess, out south. And at that time, it was real nice. People on both sides, where the interstate is.
Interstate 71.
Interstate 71, a Bruce Watkins Drive. There were homes, because Michigan was there. There were, you know, three-story homes. So the neighborhood was quite full. And we also, Horseman School also housed about 1,100 children. So you can imagine the houses must have been full to have that many children right here at Horseman School.
And so you raised children in this neighborhood. What kind of experience did they have growing up there?
Well, it was not a good one. They walked to Horseman School and walked back home while they were in elementary. When they got to 6th or 7th grade, I've forgotten exactly which grade, that's when I decided to take them to another school, because at this time the neighborhood was people began to move, and it was sort of, to me, I felt like an unsure neighborhood. But the children, I took them, they did not catch a bus, I took them to another school.
Well, I want to get back to that in a second, but why? What is your sense of why people were leaving the neighborhood?
I'm thinking that the black residents is moving and it's time for the white people to move out. I move right between a white family on either side, so they both move. So, you know, this is my thought, but it was a nice neighborhood at the time. And, of course, as they moved out, other people moved in.
And did a lot of people make the decision that you made to take your children to another neighborhood for education?
I'm thinking they did because there was some, I think, Paseo and several other schools around here, even though Paseo was a high school. But they went to schools wherever they could.
Well,
it was sort of I call it an unsure area because people were busy moving and moving in and moving out.
Also,
when we moved in, I don't remember too much about it, in 1960, that an expressway was coming through. And some people said it had been planning on coming through for the last 15 or so years. But, you know, the streets and the houses were all still there on Michigan and Euclid on the other side. So we just, you know, moved on in.
Was it during this time period that you began the block meetings that you host?
This was 60 when we moved here. In 81, 82, the blocks had already started organizing themselves, and I, busy with my children and taking them to school, and decided I did not need to attend the meetings, but eventually I did because I heard the word that they were taking, someone was stealing tags off the cars at night, so I thought, well, since they're doing all these things, I need to attend the meetings to see what's going on in the neighborhood, so that's what I did.
Tell us more about the meetings. What are they, and what does it look like? Who started it, and how?
Well, I joined it when Cora Woods was our president, and we covered four blocks. At that time, Bruce Watkins Expressway was not there. So we covered 39 on Euclid and Michigan to 40th in Euclid and Michigan, so there were four blocks that we covered. That they covered that I attended a few meetings. I didn't attend very many. But they had this going, and I, you know, wondered myself, what were they talking about? So they were busy talking about how to stay safe in case things got a little rough because people were moving in. Like I said, they were moving in and moving out. And sometimes I guess you really didn't know who was moving in or moving out.
And did people get good advice and good approaches to dealing with problems at these meetings? What kinds of things did people talk about?
Yes, we did, because a few of the meetings that I attended, police officers were present, and I thought this was good. A lot of meetings that I attended, there was at least 12 or so members there, people there, I can't say members. And I thought it was very good meetings. They were quiet, and we had a president, and they went door to door passing out notes to let us know when there was a meeting. Usually it was once a month, and we rotated homes, you know, from one home to the other. Whoever wanted to have the meeting at their homes, that's where we had them.
And you still have these meetings?
Well, we still have our block meeting. We were at one time going from 39th through 40th block, 4000 block. But we've had a few changes, so we've settled just for 3900 block from the 39th to 40th block. And we invite residents on this block because on the west side of Euclid, the freeway has taken that up. So we have just the houses on one side of the street. So we still have our monthly meeting every month.
Is everyone invited, or is it?
Everyone is invited, particularly new neighbors. The new neighbors' residents, I should say, when they move in, they usually come to one or two meetings, and after the end, they sort of wear you off. But we do keep them, do tell them what's going on around in the neighborhood or in the community. We pass out flyers, even though they, attend meetings. We speak to them, and they'll stop and talk to us and ask us what's going on. So we invite everybody on our block and anybody in the city who wants to come. Of course, we have these meetings in our home, but anybody can come to them. They're open.
What are the things that people are raising at the meetings today? Are they very different from what people were talking about when you first started attending in the 1980s?
It's, in a way, about the same. You're concerned about your car because you never know when somebody may come by and decide to take some parts or all of your car. I consider our block quiet, even though it may not be. And sometimes a person will block you, park in the driveway, but they're very kind here, I think. You just need to go out and ask them when you're ready to move, which you don't appreciate doing, but we don't have too much trouble at all.
Well, and you pick up trash. You have taken it upon yourself to make that a job of yours, a volunteer job, I should say.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
One of my neighbors and myself decided a few years ago that we would from 39th to 43rd that we would just pick up all the trash just on our Euclid Street. And the first round, we picked up 15 bags of trash just between these blocks. But after then, picking up trash once a month got a little easier because we didn't have as much trash. But now we've cut it down to just our block, and we try to encourage people to pick up their own trash. Even going around then, I would always give them a name and say, please help us keep the city clean. It would help if you just don't throw trash down, even if you don't care to pick it up. Just don't throw it down.
How do you keep from getting kind of resentful that other people are littering and you're out there cleaning it up? Do you ever find yourself holding a grudge, or are you just going to keep setting the example and not worry about it?
I've never felt that way because I've always felt that I had to lead an example, and I always felt that if I don't show that, you know, I don't mind picking up trash, even though I didn't throw it down, maybe eventually they would learn that it's not a good thing to do. And I always told them, this is our city. We must learn to keep our city, our neighborhood, our community clean. And if we don't do it, who's going to do it for us? And I do like a clean city, and I hope that they do too. They usually would stop and talk to us, and some of them was amazed. Well, you're just going around picking up trash. Yes, we are, because we want a clean city.
Well, I went to Ivanhoe yesterday and sort of wandered around, and I have to say most of the lawns are really impeccably kept up, the ones that have people living in the houses, I should add, and that's a problem we'll get to. But do you feel like you've had something to do with that?
I feel like maybe I've contributed as far as doing what I could to help totally. That's just, you know, yes.
And just as far as the importance of picking up trash, other than litter being an eyesore, is there something else that a community gains by having trash cleaned up other than just the basic, it doesn't look pretty?
I have enjoyed the feeling that when someone comes to our neighborhood, you know, they would say, gosh, this is a clean street. This block is clean. And I've had that said to me several times when, you know, visiting people would come to other people to visit and they would say this. And I would always say, thank you. We work hard in trying to keep our block clean and as much as we can of the city. And we would appreciate if you, this is our city and we must keep it clean. If we don't, we'll probably be sick with diseases. But I just always tell them, I appreciate a clean city and I'm glad that you, you know, do too, if you do. If you don't, we would like you to appreciate a clean city.
And as I hinted a second ago, I did also, on my visit yesterday, notice that some houses were abandoned and boarded up with city notices on front doors that these were unsafe buildings. Ida, you've lived in the neighborhood for a long time. When did the houses start going vacant like that? What's your understanding of why that happened?
I think a lot was, this is my feeling personally, that the white folks decided that they didn't want to stay among the black folks for the most part. This is my personal feeling. And I also feel that some people feel that they just want to, when I first moved here, and the people with lots of children, I'm from a family of 14, so I know how a group of people can destroy something, you know. So if you have lots of children, a lot of people don't want to stay around you because somehow you're going to tear up some things. So that's my feeling about it, you know. A lot of people start moving in who had a lot of children, or a number of children or people stayed in one building.
I want to bring Margaret May back into this discussion. Margaret, we met a woman at the community meeting who lives in what is now the only inhabited house on her block. So this is really a serious problem. What's being done to solve it?
We have several efforts to solve that problem. We really recognize the vacancy rate in Ivanhoe as being our greatest challenge at the moment. Vacant houses or either vacant lots. We are going to be building some new housing on the 3800 block, right the next block over from where Mrs. Dockery lives, 3800 block of Euclid. We're building some duplexes, and construction will begin soon. And on the 3800 block of Garfield, we have received approval from the Missouri Housing Development Commission, MHDC, for some one-story senior cottages. We also are working with several developers that are actually acquiring and rehabbing vacant houses. We have some good, strong housing stock in Ivanhoe that's currently vacant, houses that can be rehabbed. We have a few of those that are vacant that need to be torn down, and so we have some plans to try to accomplish those things, hopefully within the next 3 to 5 years.
Do you see people just sort of on their own noticing that that's an opportunity, that there are these houses that they could rehab and move into just as individuals?
very pleased to say that, yes, that in the past year we're seeing more of that. And also, since the city now has the land bank and the homesteading authority, there are individuals that are interested in purchasing those homes. And we're really pleased with the process the city has in place, because they require the people that are interested in purchasing the homes to show what they're planning to do, show that they have funding to do it, and also they kind of do background check on the individuals to make sure that they aren't people with bad reputations. And then those folks come to our housing committee meeting, and we have an opportunity to then say to the city, yes, we recommend that you sell this property to this individual, or no, we don't think that's a good thing for you to do.
Do you agree with Ida's perspective on what it was historically in Ivanhoe that caused so many of these houses to become vacant?
Well, I have never lived in Ivanhoe. I work there. And I think in part what Mrs. Dockery says is my sense of what happened. But I probably have a little longer explanation than that. I really think that the acquisition of property for Bruce R. Watkins Drive, and the fact that there were lawsuits in connection with that, and we had for about 30 years vacant land where Bruce R. Watkins Drive is now. It's an asset to the community, but can you imagine all of that land being vacant with no improvements on it for 30 years? And that became Ivanhoe's broken window. And you know about the broken window syndrome, that if you don't repair that window, what happens? Well, from that vacancy in the middle of the neighborhood came a lot of bad things. And as time passed,
The broken window thing is that one small problem unattended to turns into a larger
problem.
There
you go. There you go. And we have a lot of people who have passed away, and they've left their property to their children, who either elected to stay there or elected not to. And so some of the – there's a variety of reasons for the numbers of vacant properties that we have. And I don't want to leave out the folks that – speculators that buy the properties and slap some paint on and rent for a big price. And then the people aren't able to pay the rent, and they move. And then they do that three or four times. And then the next thing you know, you have a house that can't be repaired.
Wow.
So there's lots of reasons.
Well, and you did just lay out some of the ways that you're working on that problem. But speaking of solving problems, we had Chief of Police Daryl Forte in the studio last week. And when I asked him how ordinary citizens could reduce crime in their own neighborhoods, wherever their neighborhoods may be, he said that cleaning up vacant lots and fronts of houses made a difference, and pointed to Ivanhoe as an example for other parts of the city, saying that some blocks in Ivanhoe had seen real success in reducing crime, mostly by tidying up and showing that someone cares. Is that your sense as well?
Absolutely. And we've been helped with that, with the Bright TIF program, for one. We have a section of the neighborhood where we receive some funding from the TIF Commission to assist people with home repairs. We also do home repair for the city. We have a minor home repair grant. So lots of things have happened. I probably should have made a list of all of the things that have contributed to it. But we have many reasons for the improvement that's been made in the neighborhood. But most of all, it's the people like Mrs. Dockery who are the ones that have really brought about the good things that are occurring in the neighborhood now.
It sounds like there was a pretty rough spell there, with residents hearing gunshots all the time and living in fear. And it also sounds like there's some consensus that it's gotten a whole lot better in recent years. And you just kind of walked us through that. But one of the things that still seems to bother people in the neighborhood is that there used to be lots of businesses in Ivanhoe, businesses along Prospect and so forth, but that they left and haven't come back. Can you paint a picture of that for us?
Well, we need businesses, and we want businesses, and we really believe that getting the vacant houses occupied, building new houses, getting people in the neighborhood, we won't have to beg the businesses anymore.
And maybe I'd like, Ida, maybe you can also share with us some of your observations about this, because when you moved to Ivanhoe, were there lots of businesses thriving in the neighborhood?
There was.
Tell us a little about them.
I can't point out any right now. I remember we had a grocery store around the corner, a little, whatever you call it, where they sell little foods. on the corner of 39th and Euclid, was it South, whatever corner it is. And what else did we have? Anyway, we had things that was convenient for us to go and purchase right around here. And it was really condensed with people when I moved here because I worked, and I worked a lot of times nights, so I slept days while the children were in school. So I did not have too much involvement with the neighborhood, except when I heard about the car tags being stolen. I thought, well, it's time for me to get involved with some more people to find out why they're doing these things and what I can do to keep mine. But it was very, because I often thought about that, how many people were here before they start tearing the, before they start, you know, moving south.
Well, I want to get back to the businesses that are there now and what's going on with that maybe a little later. But Ida, before we go to break, what do you think is the most important thing for the rest of the city to know about what it's like to live in Ivanhoe now?
I think it's okay. It's quiet. We have a convenient bus line, 39th, going down 39th. We have a filling station about a block, half a block from me, a block from me. We have an Aldi's grocery store about six blocks from me, and we have the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Center, of course, which offer a lot of things of coming together and some place to go and have entertainment or enjoy yourself or just relax. We have the yard there that's full of things for the children to do.
Well, I'd like
Ivanhoe Neighborhood.
Thanks so much. I'd like to thank Ida Dockery for joining us this morning. We're going to let her get back to her exercise class. Thanks, Ida. Have a great rest
thank
of your
you so
morning.
Much. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Ida Dockery is an Ivanhoe resident who has been holding block meetings and picking up trash in her neighborhood for decades. We'll return to our conversation about Ivanhoe with Margaret May after a short break. This is Central Standard. Why don't you talk? Welcome back to Central Standard. We'll return to our great conversation about the Ivanhoe neighborhood in just a moment. But first, it's time for our weekly Tell KCUR segment, where social media producer Allison Rollitz shares your answers to a question we've asked. And Allison, what did we ask this week?
Well, hi, Gina. As you know, Wednesday, that marked the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And at the station, we wanted to know, what are today's biggest challenges for civil rights? And so that's what we asked on the airwaves and on social media all week.
Such a fascinating topic. We had a conversation about the Civil Rights Act on this show just yesterday, delving into that history. But what do our listeners think are the big civil rights challenges we face today?
Okay, well, they came back with about a handful of kind of really common themes, I would say. Foremost, like racism was a common category or theme that came back. And a lot of folks particularly mentioned the unequal enforcement of drug laws for black men as a big challenge facing racism today. Marriage equality, which has been in the news specifically in Missouri a lot in the past few weeks, that was a big theme, along with just discrimination based on sexual preference. Those were both very common threads. Kyle, for instance, on Twitter, he sent us this message. LGBT citizens, especially in Missouri, don't have equal access to the law, and that's just un-American. Another one that I'm not sure if we quite expected, but people talked about access to the voting booth as being a big challenge to civil rights today. And then we really had people just kind of bring up a lot of just kind of various other issues, such as women reproductive rights. And one person even talked about how indoor smoking bans infringe on civil rights. And I believe your show reported a few months ago about how that's going on in Jackson County.
Yeah, we're hearing a lot of things that are in the news on this very station. And you got a few phone calls this week that you brought in to play for us, right? Tell us about those.
Yes, definitely. Well, here's a caller who didn't leave his name, but talked about racism and specifically how racism and segregation play into school boundaries.
Or one of the biggest barriers is the discomfort of individuals with different backgrounds with living next to each other. So I feel like what happens is you have neighborhoods that are segregated, and therefore you have school districts that are segregated, and then you have unequal school systems. And because you have a discrepancy in education, that contributes to a discrepancy in opportunities and how much citizens can contribute to the future, which I think further feeds the cycle.
Wow.
So that's a really interesting point, very detailed point.
Yeah, we actually, just last week, Brianna O'Higgins, our digital editor, she wrote a web post about how racism and segregation kind of played into Kansas City school boundaries. So it was just so interesting to hear his thoughts about that. And we had another caller, Elizabeth Foster from Prairie Village. She was one of the people I mentioned who spoke about voting rights.
And the biggest challenge to civil rights these days is the desecration of the Voting Rights Act. If people get disenfranchised from their vote, then they have less power to enact change on our society in the future. It's very alarming to me that voting rights are being taken away from many people.
So the caller is referring to the 2013 Supreme Court decision to strike down parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, freeing 9 states to change their election laws without federal approval. And a lot of people expressed similar disappointment to what the caller is expressing.
Mm-hmm. We actually had a few mentions on Twitter about the same thing. In addition to asking people to call in, tweet, and Facebook, our Kara McLean actually went out to Midtown and Westport this week to kind of throw this question at some people that she met. And she ran into Paul Mesner of Paul Mesner Puppets, and he talked to her about economic disparity. Here's his message.
There's even more this economic disparity that separates people of all races. It's like one part of me says, okay, a certain amount of people have to die off before we can move forward. Not a good answer, maybe. Another part says there's tons of work to do. We're not nearly as far as people think. The legislation did something, but now people's hearts have to change. You can change the laws, but people have to open their hearts and stop being bigots.
Well, that's a fairly straightforward message from Paul Mesner. Well, Allison, it was great talking with you today, as always. How can people continue this conversation if they're interested in that?
If you're hearing this conversation and you want to chime in, we're still taking feedback. Just go ahead and tweet us with the hashtag TellKCUR or go on to our Facebook page. And also, posting very shortly, we're going to have an online roundup of a lot of the feedback. So if you'd like to read more about what people said, just go to KCUR.org. And thank you so much, Gina.
Yeah, thank you, Allison. Let's return now to our conversation with Margaret May, leader of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council. Margaret, your organization just received a $4,000 grant, and we got that news yesterday. It's a grant from the American Heart Association. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I tell you, we're so excited about that grant to help support our health initiatives through Kansas City, or I won't say Kansas City, KC Healthy Kids. We worked with them to get a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And so for the past going on 5 years now, we have been working. Actually, the original intent was to end childhood obesity, but that has expanded into just health in general for our children and adults. And so we've been working with American Heart Association cooperatively over the past few years. We really appreciate their partnership. And when we heard about, we're going to get some money from them yesterday, we were overjoyed.
You talked about some of the bigger health concerns for children in the neighborhood. What are the health concerns for children specific to Ivanhoe?
Well, you know, we in the Ivanhoe neighborhood, like most center city neighborhoods that have predominantly African-American or Latino or Hispanic, however you prefer to refer to our other people of color, we have lots of health issues that primarily blood pressure problems, heart disease, diabetes. And a lot of those things are attributable to how people eat and their ability to exercise and to practice a healthy lifestyle.
What gets in the way of that?
Well, just think about neighborhoods like Ivanhoe as far as the physical conditions. Quite often there may be either no sidewalks or sidewalks in ill repair. The fact that food deserts are throughout the center city. We were blessed in February this year, after 10 years of hard work, to get an Aldi store.
And was that the first time there had been a grocery store there in that time?
Oh, yes, for many, many, many years. But most neighborhoods don't have a grocery store. And what they may have is a liquor store that might have potato chips and candy and things that aren't healthy at
all.
And
liquor.
And liquor. And yes, and no, we don't even want to go. That's a whole nother radio show just to talk about that.
Just the liquor stores.
Yes. These things can contribute to poor health.
Well, I'd like to put out a call to our listeners. If you've lived in the Ivanhoe neighborhood, or if you live there now, give us a call and tell us what you think matters most to the neighborhood today. How do you think Ivanhoe is doing? The number to call is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. We've got Margaret May in the studio. She's from the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council. And Margaret, we mentioned earlier in the show that you actually don't live in Ivanhoe, but your name is synonymous with the neighborhood for so many people. Can you tell us more about that? How do you think that has evolved?
Well, I retired from the Social Security Administration in 1998 and thought I wanted to be a nursing home administrator. But within a few weeks of retiring, the pastors at the churches along Swope Parkway, the St. Louis Catholic Church, Covenant Presbyterian Church, the Church of Christ, the Christian Church, they had all been doing some visioning about the neighborhood. And to make a long story short, about 15 of us met at the end of March 1999 and started working to form the Swope Corridor Renaissance. I was working with them and served as president when I saw the announcement for the Ivanhoe job, and I commented to my husband, looks like they're going to hire someone to do what I've been doing for free. So I applied and participated in a competitive process, and they hired me to be the executive director. And I started to work there October 22nd, 2001.
You remember the day to the date?
To the date. And it's been quite an adventure. Again, Mrs. Dockery is a good example of the people in Ivanhoe, how they care about the neighborhood, their vision, their willingness to do what needs to be done to the maximum extent, rather than saying, someone come and pick up this paper for me. They do what they can do. And so when you can work with people who know what they want, they had a plan that they gave me, which I work for them. And it's my job to try to help move along this path that they started.
It sounds like you've forged some really strong relationships. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about your own background, where you came from, and what you think it might be about you that allows you to forge these kinds of relationships. Where were you born?
I was born in Kansas City, Kansas. Spent the first 2 weeks of my house in Bell Memorial Hospital, that's now called KU Medical Center. Back in those days, women stayed in the hospital 2 weeks. Can you imagine that?
It's very different.
So I have a Kansas birth certificate, but I've lived in Kansas City, Missouri most of my life. My mom was a community activist. They weren't calling folks that then. But I can recall we lived in an apartment building on 21st and Benton, and my mom used to have block meetings in our apartment.
Block meetings seem a popular thing.
Well, they weren't called that.
What were they called?
I don't remember. It's just the people on the block came to our house and they worked on problems that were occurring on the block.
What were the kinds of problems that your mom was solving in your neighborhood then?
I don't remember exactly what they were. I just remember them having them. It's been, I'm getting pretty old now, so I don't remember exactly. But I just distinctly remember that she got the folks together on whatever the issue was. And may have even been schools, because we had a lot of, I remember school closing in April a couple of times when I was going to school, because the district didn't have enough money to continue beyond that. But I think that plus working for Social Security, my last years there, I was the director of human resources, having owned our own business, being very active, my husband and I, with our children when they were going to school. All of those things are things that I think helped me to be prepared to do the work I do today. And I truly love the work I do today.
When you first got to the neighborhood and saw the plan that the neighborhood residents had drawn up for you, this was going to be your work over the next however many years, was there anything on that list of to-do items that really intimidated you?
Not anything on that list was intimidating. They actually had outlined in the plan action steps and then a list of people that we needed to work with to accomplish the things in the plan. I think the first time that I was intimidated a bit was around 2003. Alan Young, who was president at that time, came to me and he says, "You know, Mrs. May, we're going to have to become a community development corporation because we have all these vacant houses and all this vacant land, and we need to do that so that we can make sure things happen the way we want them to happen." And I said, "A what?" Well, I knew what a community development corporation was. I didn't have the wildest idea of, you know, I couldn't even imagine how we would go about doing that. But
is that something you have done?
That is something we've done over time. And with the encouragement of Liz, we have become a CDC, or Community Development Corporation.
Explain what that means.
Well, it means that we have housing and community improvement as a part of who we are and what we do. And we're able to apply for and get some funding, some federal dollars that the city controls for various things that are related to improving the community.
Such as?
The minor home repair. We receive funding from the city, that is federal dollars, to be able to do home repair at homes. And I've got to just give you, throw out a number. I think surely it's been 300 or more houses since 2008 that we have repaired either through that program or the Bright TIF program.
Wow.
We also are, I mentioned the housing that we're getting ready to build, and the city is helping us with that, as is Mr. Nutter. And we received a small amount of funding from the fire. We own the Horace Mann School, and when some idiot set fire to the school, we finally were able to get a small amount of money from the insurance company, and we set aside a part of that for the duplexes we're going to build.
And part of what you're trying to solve with all of this is this issue of vacancy. Do you feel confident that there are people who are going to move into these places once they're built?
Oh, yes. We feel very confident. We haven't even announced the application process for the one-story senior cottages, and we have six people on the waiting list already. We haven't actually formally announced that we're selling the duplexes. We haven't even started building either of these new housing projects. But we have people already that are in contact with Bryant Real Estate Company that will be selling the duplexes for us. So we have no reservation at all about our ability to be able to sell them and to have the rental units occupied.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Margaret May, who is the leader of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council. And Margaret, tell us about some of the other things going on in your neighborhood. There's a new farmers market that seems to have a lot of people really excited, and some community gardening projects.
Right. And I need to say that I'm the executive director, so I'm the paid person that works for the board. And our leader actually is Dennis Robinson, who's president of the Ivanhoe board. And we have a total of nine people on the boards. They're really the leaders. And then the people in the neighborhood who are the volunteer leaders. So I'm just the person that...
You're just the mere executive director.
Yeah, yes, I do what they tell me to do. We do have a farmer's market that we just opened on the 20th of June. And we have it every Friday evening in our parking lot from 5 o'clock to 7. And it's a lot of fun. And we have, in addition to the produce vendors, we also have... some other vendors now. One of our residents has bath products that she makes, And so they're made very organically, and they're very healthy and safe. We have another vendor that has T-shirts that she makes and other items, jewelry and what have you. So please come to our market 5 to 7 on Friday through the end of September.
And I want to get back to the food piece of the market, because you had mentioned earlier in the show that there were just, you know, within very recent years, there was very little access to food in the neighborhood. And now you have these farmers markets and people are growing the food within the neighborhood, right?
That's correct.
Tell us more about who is growing the food and maybe whether are people coming and taking advantage of this opportunity to have vegetables and these other fresh things.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more how this started. The Healthcare Foundation provided some funding for us to be able to start our Grown in Ivanhoe program. We work very closely with the Master Gardeners of Greater Kansas City, and they help us with the classes that we have once a month. We have a certification program to become a certified grower. And the first go-around, we had seven people who actually are classified as certified growers. We're now, sometimes we have 30 or 35 people that attend those classes, and we have them on the second Tuesday of every month at our building. And by the way, we're located at 3700 Woodland. Then we are teaching them how to grow without pesticides. And we are then teaching them how to market what they grow and to sell what they grow.
And someone at the meeting with KCUR kind of mentioned that vegetables are a tough sell. Can you talk about that?
Well, because a lot of people, because of not having access to good, healthy food over a few generations now, don't know how to cook vegetables. And a lot of our children don't eat vegetables. They say they don't like them. And so we have a number of things that we've been doing, trying to expose them to them. We have cooking classes. We have an experiential learning project where we actually had children to taste vegetables over one of the courses that we have. And did I tell you the carrot story?
No, tell the carrot
story.
Well,
we had fresh carrots the first night of the class, and the kids were all getting carrots and eating them. We had one little boy that said, "Carrots? I don't like carrots." And then, so our instructor, Yolanda Young, one of our staff members, said, "How do you know you don't like carrots?" And he says, "I just know I don't like them." "Well, have you ever tasted them?" "Well, no, I just know I don't like them." Well, the other kids were enjoying them so much that they finally got him to take a carrot. Standing there in front of them to taste it, he went off into a corner, and a few minutes later he came back and he said, "Could I have some more?" And so I think that many things that people say they don't like or they're not doing is just because they don't know. And so that's a great part of what we try to do in Ivanhoe, is to be an information giving and sharing organization.
And the gardens themselves, I went past them yesterday, and they looked very pretty. I mean, there were bright purple leafy things coming out of the ground, and the area around it's pretty well maintained. And there's a sign letting people know what number they can call if they want a plot. Tell us more about the project itself, how the garden is maintained.
Well, the Master Gardeners maintain the garden that's right directly to the north of our building. And it's called a demonstration garden. And so they've been trying each year some new things. Like last year, they grew collard greens with a screen over them, because there's something about the direct sun on collard greens that prohibits their growth.
Huh.
And they found that this screen worked very well. We also invite people in the neighborhood to come and also take part or have a plot within the Master Gardeners area. And we have a number of people that are doing that now. So it's a chance for them to actually work side by side with the Master Gardeners and learn from them. The Master Gardeners harvest on Mondays, and on Mondays all of the produce is brought into our building and it's made available for people in the neighborhood who need to come and get it. And then they harvest again on Thursdays, and that is used on Fridays as part of what we sell at our farmers market.
Is there anyone in the neighborhood who has learned how to garden and really thrived in it? Do you have a story of a person who has really, who is really taken to this as a possible career even?
Well, I think the two stars are Eileen Ellis and Francine Nelson. And they have been having been vendors at our farmers market each year that we've started it. We have others that also are growing, but they're the ones that are the dependable folks that just have been there from beginning to now. And so I call them our experts.
And earlier in the show, we talked a bit about businesses that had moved out of the neighborhood and that have not entirely been replaced. Can you talk a little bit more about the businesses that are in the neighborhood now and maybe what you think you might be able to do to increase that process?
Well, again, we're really hoping that the Aldi store is very, very successful. Everyone tells us they have a good shopping experience there, and we're really hoping that other businesses will see how well Aldi's is doing and that they will come and locate along 39th Street. We don't have a lot of businesses. There is a Walgreens down on Linwood and an AutoZone on Prospect. A few small businesses here and there. But as we're able to get additional people living in the vacant houses, we really feel that there will be a greater demand for services, and businesses like to be where they know people will come and do business with them. So businesses, come on.
Well, have you had conversations with business owners encouraging them to move there? And do you have a sense of what is preventing people from doing that now?
We haven't actually done that to the degree that we're hoping to be able to do into the future. You know, we have so many things that we've been working on. We have this laundry list of things that we need to do, will do, but we haven't gotten to that one to the extent that we need to.
And then just as far as the future goes, what's the next thing on your big to-do list that maybe you haven't gotten to yet but you're excited about?
Well, the housing is the big thing right now, trying to get the housing built that I mentioned and some more. And then we have a constant need to try to identify for fundraising, for operating support. When not-for-profit organizations like ours, it's not easy to get funding, period, but often it's easier to get some programmatic funding. It's hard for people to understand that we do need to keep our lights on and doors open. So funding. We need funding.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation about Ivanhoe. I'd like to thank Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council, for being here. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day, Margaret.
Thank you, Gina.
We also spoke with Ida Dockery earlier in the show. To listen back to today's conversation or any past shows, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. To stay current on Central Standard News, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tomorrow is the 4th of July. We'll be airing a holiday special during this hour, and the Central Standard crew wishes you all a happy Independence Day. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, along with interns Matt Hodapp and Christina Leffring. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, for which we are eternally grateful. Stick around for Up to Date next. I'm Gina Kaufman.